Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 40. We've got something really special for you on this episode. I know we're not doing a movie review, but we're doing a genre review of sorts. Recently, if you're familiar with this show and have listened to any amount of episodes, you'll probably recognize some of the people that I was able to work with recently. J.R. Forresteros of Origami Elephants and the Story Men, Clay Morgan of the Story Men, Bryn Lewis of Origami Elephants, these great podcasters. We all got together and we submitted a paper on the horror genre for the Baylor Faith and Film Symposium. We were selected. We all got to go out there. We're out there for a couple days. It was a really great symposium. For those of you who don't know, S.J. Murray, she hosted us. She is incredible. She did a great job at moderating our panel, making us feel at home in her home away from home at Baylor University down in Waco, Texas. It was a great experience. We got to, like, lots of us were meeting each other for the very first time in person, and that's always a wonderful thing. If you're a podcaster or you get to do anything over the internet, which is making our world smaller and smaller, it's always amazing when you get to build these relationships in person. So we had this horror panel that we got to present on, talking about the horror genre and how Christians are interacting with that and how faith intersects that genre. We all did a little something different, and it came together in this one really awesome, really exciting thing. So I hope you enjoy this. It's basically a pretty rough audio of our presentation there. We'll have some Q&A at the end. I hope you enjoy it. This is episode 40, What's Gotten Into Us, Possession, Haunting, and the Christian Tradition in Recent American Cinema. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Hi, everyone. I hope you're having a great time this week. I'm S.J. Murray. I'm a professor here in the Honors College, for those of you who do not know me. My specialty is story, whether it be in great text, which I teach in, or film and digital media, and story design, and screenwriting. And I'm really excited to welcome all these guests. These guys are all friends of mine, some for longer and some for shorter, but all good friends. What they all have in common, I think, is the ability to take complex ideas and to communicate them to the general public in a way that's digestible, fun, and engaging. So this is going to be a great session. In fact, I know that a large part of the session we hope will be devoted to conversation and to fielding questions from you after the presenters have spoken. And we really conceive of like the second part of the session today as a roundtable so that we can really get to the bottom of it. Hopefully nobody will leave oppressed or possessed. And that concept will stay in the title, What's Gotten Into Us, Possession, Haunting, and the Christian Tradition in Recent American Cinema. You know, I think it's really fascinating. The concept of dealing with the demonic in cinema when it was introduced, right, in Nosferatu and things like that around 1922, was really there to bolster our understanding of faith. And obviously over years we've seen that shift, and we've seen a sort of glamorization or a real exaltation of the demonic sometimes. And these guys are all going to ask to some degree, you know, what does that mean? What does that look like? Is that really real? And what can we learn from the shifting views of haunting and possession and demons in recent cinema? You know, why are we so fascinated with this? So we're going to change the order of the program just a little bit. Clay is going to be up first. Clay is right here. And I'm going to introduce you all very quickly first, Clay, so you don't have to run yet. He spoke to my students yesterday also, to a very acclaimed Full House. He now has very avid fans at Baylor. Clay, what is one of the reasons, rather than give you professional bios for them, I'm just going to ask them to answer a question for you so you can get to know them before you hear them speak. Why did the undead become a fascination to you?
Because zombies are cool.
Or I could answer.
And I was like, man, I want to watch cool stuff, and I better figure out something academic to say about it. But yeah, I'll review a little bit more about it in my talk. But yeah, I like to see why our culture is fascinated in certain things.
Good. And, you know, I should say, don't let these guys' laid-back attitude fool you. They're really, really good at what they do. They're also just really humble about it and really good at engaging with their readers, whether it be on blogs or amazing podcasts. And you should get that information from them before you leave today, too. Then we are going to hear from Bryn. You're up next, right? Bryn, like, what makes your heart sing at the moment? What are you working on?
What makes my heart sing at the moment? So I just found out that there's a film festival that's devoted to presenting poetry in a film setting. It's called the Rabbit Hearts Poetry Film Festival. It's in Boston, and I am interested in filmmaking, and I write poetry, and I was like, did they make this for me? That's amazing! So I'm really looking forward to putting something together for next year for that festival.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'd encourage everybody else to think about attending also. Next up will be J.R. Forresteros, who is awesome. This guy is literally the hippest, coolest pastor you will ever meet. And when you hear people give statistics about, oh, the younger generations, they're not going to the church, to me, J.R. is the answer to how that's going to change. He's also a great film critic and an amazing podcast host. And he's here, recently relocated to Dallas, right? So, J.R., what's your favorite thing about Texas thus far?
The fact that it's still 83 degrees today, and buddy texted me yesterday and said when he was getting into his car in Ohio, it was 38 degrees. I thought, that sounds like a terrible way to live, and I'm glad I'm not there anymore.
And then we'll wrap up our discussions. Actually, JR's going to go, I've got this wrong, JR's going to go last. Before him, we'll hear from Mikey, who's with Real World Theology. And Mikey, what's your passion?
Well, at the moment, it's podcasting, specifically about the narratives and themes that are shaping culture. I had a long history of watching movies incessantly, and almost like Clay joked, I kind of needed to figure out a reason to be spending this much time doing it. And
I wasn't joking.
Yeah. Yeah, neither am I. So I decided that, or actually I came along with someone who talked about the power of story and how it was influencing culture, how, you know, and a film about superheroes can, you know, make over $1 billion. And while people, a younger generation, don't seem to want to go to church, they seem to pay to go hear stories about people's interpretations of morality, God, culture, social issues. So there must be something more there. So I love exploring those through the power of story. Jesus told stories. And so
absolutely,
it's a natural thing for us to want to do in here.
Well, these guys are all a great source of inspiration to me. I hope they will be to you also. We all stand to learn a great deal from them. And without further ado, we're going to get underway with what...
Yeah, some of you might have seen my zombie talk yesterday. I do all the normal academic things. I really do like the panel discussion format, so... if you haven't attended one of these, you see it has a lot more opportunity for interaction. So I'm going to start with a question. How many of you believe in ghosts? Show of hands, we're going there, okay?
The panel's all in.
I want it. Okay, here comes the twist. How many of you have been in contact with a dead person? Now you're thinking, do I raise my hand? Oh, I mean, do I read it metaphorically? Well, one of the things that I'm into is the way this question has been asked in society over a long time. The way we've answered those questions as a culture has dramatically changed over the past 2 decades. One of my current research goals is to find out why. What are we haunted by, and what does it even mean to be haunted? So we're going to get into some of the specific cinema stuff. The culture definitely is pumping this out. Now, I have some statistics, and that's why I'm going first. So I'm going to do the big bird's eye view from all these studies that affirm how haunted our culture seems to be. More than 3 times as many people believe in the paranormal today than in the 1970s, when the Exorcist movie hit theaters and forever changed the cultural definition of horror. According to a 2005 Gallup poll, 45% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 believe in ghosts. So that's about half, but the numbers go way further than that. So I'm going to give you a few of these that I think are entirely relevant to what we're talking about today. In 2012, Huffington Post and YouGov combined on a poll, and 64% of people said they believe in life after death. Another 21% said they weren't sure. So the question that we're after when we get to, I guess, the believability of the kind of stories we're going to talk about here, possessions and demons, is what do we think about life after death? In CBS, in 2005, a CBS poll asked if people had personally seen or felt the presence of a ghost. Now, at that time, the response rate was about 22%. But the number that really has fascinated me most in driving this all forward is what the Pew Forum found out, the Religious and Public Life Research Society, in 2009, when they saw 29%, almost 30% of people said they have been in touch with a dead person. And as you just experienced a minute ago, it's a very different question to say, yeah, I could get down with ghosts, I think I could believe in ghosts, than to next say, I've been in touch with a dead person, you know. And if you have been in touch with a dead person, a lot of people are like, I don't want to put my hand up on that one. But 30% of people, and when they ask this question for the last 50 years, the number always stayed kind of down in the 15, 16% range. What happened in 16 years that made that number double to where 3 out of 10 people have these strong feelings about what we would call paranormal beings? Supernatural is something about, you know, defying the natural order. Paranormal comes with some scientific connotations, and that's what these researchers are looking for. So, when you ask people to report whether they've had any kind of sudden religious insight or awakening, what the researchers called mystical experiences, it was a yes response of 22% back in 1962. Now, the number has radically jumped, and it's up to 49%. So we went from only like 25% of people saying they would consider having these personal experiences. So you'll see what I'm moving towards in arguing is that movies are more than just movies. And when it comes to anything that explains a spiritual reality, there is a real power potentially there. And the statistics keep on coming. So let's get to the scary stuff. Back to that HuffPo poll. The question was, do you believe that ghosts or spirits can harm or otherwise interact with living people? 32% said yes, and another 25% were unsure. So you've got less than 50% answering no when asked if they think that potentially spirits could harm people. And when you watch most possession stories, they usually aren't, you know, Pixar films. A feel-good story about how the demon came and saved the day.
Monsters, Inc.
Monsters, Inc. There you go. That's one example. In 2007, here's my final research bit for you, but I think this is important. The Gallup poll is the big organization. They found this. Americans' belief in God had declined just slightly between 2001 and 2007 from 90 to 86%. And in the same time, the belief in the devil had actually ticked upwards to 70%. It appears we're losing faith in heaven as we gain a fear of hell. Maybe heaven isn't for real. In 1991, only 52% of Americans claimed belief in the devil. Fast forward to from 1996 to 2007, and the belief in hell went up from 56 to 69%. And these are, you know, wide ranges of respondents. So Gallup said this: there has been some change in these measures of belief in the devil over time. In several surveys conducted in the 90s, less than 60% of Americans said they believed in the devil. The three surveys conducted since 2001 have all shown roughly 70%. So what do horror films, particularly movies about the demonic and possession, have to do with statistical trends? Writing in an anthology called The Horror Film, Stephen Prince says that the horror genre goes deeper than the other ones. And he says, quote, "To explore more fundamental questions about the nature of human existence, questions that in some profound ways go beyond culture and society, as these are organized in any given period of form." So over time, monsters have been moving from farther away to ever closer. Once upon a time, Dracula was in Eastern Europe. The mummy was far off in Egypt, and Frankenstein was also out there somewhere, right? We learned about these exotic creatures from far, far away, and even from ancient times. Chronologically, they were distanced as well. Then we had aliens from space, mutants from the ocean, and zombies from the Caribbean. But into the 20th century, the threat was moving ever closer. Still, these monsters were so foreign, literally alien at times. In cinema, they got much closer when Hitchcock showed us we weren't even safe from other people, not even in our showers. But then came the big one, The Exorcist. No longer was evil out there, but rather it came from within, and we became the monsters. Cinematic horror hit upon a more dynamic terror as viewers feared not just losing our lives, psycho, but losing our humanity, and perhaps even our soul. By the way, in the world of Ebola and similar threats, I wonder how our fear of pandemic and infection plays into fears of possession. There's nothing like an invisible threat to make us feel completely helpless. In possession movies, it's usually a person who doesn't want to get possessed, as if they can't stave off the demonic infection. In a world of deadly pathogens, monsters seem to be everywhere. Invisible evil lurks all around us. We wait to see which coworker, student, neighbor, fellow passenger on an airplane is about to unleash the next threat. So we are haunted. And with a couple of comments, I want to turn this back over to my friends here. But films are our primary outlet for us as we seek to understand supernatural encounters, often firsthand experiences, whether beautiful, baffling, or terrifying. The search is personal. Movies about the paranormal consistently revolve around regret and the unresolved issues of individuals or societies. I feel like ghost stories are often time travel stories. It's the attempt to go back in time and right wrongs, right? So a ghost presents some trauma from the past. Demons also lead us into this area. Perhaps it's no surprise that the two most successful horror movies of all time, The Sixth Sense, I know it's not the scariest ever, but pretty chiller, and The Exorcist, were written by devoutly religious individuals. The trend continues today as modern filmmakers like Scott Derrickson and the Hayes brothers, who wrote The Reaping and The Conjuring, continue to impact the box office with such films designed to confront dark, existential questions while attempting to impart some sort of meaning. By the way, Wes Craven went to Wheaton, and then he taught at a Presbyterian college before he went and made films like Nightmare on Elm Street. I argue that by addressing questions of evil and consistently framing the conversation in a Christian worldview, horror cinema has become a key communicator of spiritual possibilities and even realities for the large population of people identified by Baylor researchers Christopher Bader, Carson Mencken, and Joseph Baker as somewhere in between naturalistic skeptics and committed religious adherents. In their book Paranormal America, they show that both individuals with no religious beliefs, as well as the most committed individuals, those who attend services weekly, are among the least likely to hold paranormal beliefs. While people on either extreme are less likely to believe, the large middle is curious and growing. And that's where I find the greatest fascination with my study. Here's one other interesting stat as I finish up. A longitudinal study by Barna Group showed that less than 25% of teens between the ages, I think, of 14 to 19 said that they had ever heard any kind of teaching or instruction from church or religious leaders on things like the cult, the paranormal, and such things. That same group then reported that up to about 75%, almost three-quarters of them, had gone and experimented with things like Ouija boards, seances, cult activities. So the lesson is pretty obvious, I think. People are curious about this, especially the young people, and they're going to go investigate it. So what correlations are there between the number of curious teens and the market share of young viewers, those who have disposable income for films and are perhaps more susceptible to views being formed in a substantial way by the powerful visual medium of film? We need eternity. Cognitive scientists are becoming increasingly aware of the fundamental metaphysical outlook shared by all humans. We're never going to stop being obsessed with the afterlife and, by extension, the supernatural paranormal. As Western nations continue to become post-Christian, our churches may get emptier, but our cineplexes are going to get more full. They'll remain packed and, in so doing, remain a central forum for spiritually based conversations. So is it possible that our beliefs can be influenced by a medium which requires our suspension of disbelief? Is it possible that a middling, undecided demographic may stop suspending disbelief and come to accept the views as their new worldview? As trends in paranormal belief continue to trend up, it's not unreasonable to think that cultural forces such as film might play some formative role in further developing cultural beliefs about life after death. My fellow panelists may not agree, but they can talk more about what is changing in horror cinema, so I'll turn it over to them.
So I want to encourage those of you who are on social media, don't forget we have a hashtag, Faith and Film, for the conference. We're at Baylor IFL, and Clay is on Twitter at ClayMorganPA. Bryn, are you on Twitter?
Yep.
What is yours, so I can make sure I tweet
Bryn
yours?
Lewis.
Bryn Lewis, okay,
yep.
Awesome.
Yeah. So
So I am going to talk about specifically about exorcism movies, so portrayals of the demonic. There's been this really interesting shift that, you know, like demons are the new little black dress everybody's wearing this season. You know, like zombies are so 2012, like nobody wears that anymore. But I think horror movies in particular kind of point to our anxieties as a culture and kind of mount a significant criticism of institutions and values in the same way that like zombie movies kind of pointed to this unease we have with a strictly materialist account of the soul, especially in contrast to kind of our emerging technical prowess with bioengineering. Like, we can make all these crazy viruses that, but, you know, and we have animated corpses, but, like, what's the difference? Like, how do we account for that soul part? They're not a person. Like, that's really scary because we can't, that extra bit we can't put our hand on. So the new upsurge, the fact that, like, this demonic movie thing just, like, washed up on shore in this kind of tidal wave is really culturally significant. It's a significant shift in popular beliefs concerning the nature of religious experience and the Christian church's ability to effectively shepherd those experiences. So I just wanted to walk you through some of the standard motifs in contemporary exorcism movies that form what I see as the basis of this criticism kind of taken as a whole. First of all, demonic narratives are constructed in an almost exclusively Christian context. This is a big shift. If you look at like recent posters for exorcism films, they're loaded with Christian imagery. There's just a strong correlation. And this strong identification with the Christian church is in marked contrast to the films of the same genre from the 1960s, like Rosemary's Baby, any of the Hammer horror films, even Black Sunday, in which the demonic was portrayed as satanic. And to kind of differentiate from some of the statistics that Clay was quoting, by satanic here, I really mean like a kind of evil for its own sake. Not unlike the portrayal of monsters that have kind of like an independent mythology, like vampires and werewolves. This is like evil with its own set of rules, its own set of rituals. So in these films from like the 60s, Christian iconography is largely absent or only present in a perfunctory way. You know, like Dracula's scared of crucifixes, but it doesn't really figure very largely in his portrait. Whereas the most recent batch of demonic films make extensive use of Christian symbols, the rite, the devil inside. The confrontation is direct and even essential. Along these lines, in many exorcism films, the focal point of the ritual, as per the film, is the portion of the rite where the demon is asked to name itself. And in a certain sense, the Christian church is understood to identify and define the demonic in these films. My point is not that possession is contemporarily understood as a uniquely Christian experience, although I think that's interesting considering the church's kind of unease about a demonic accounts in its own canon. But rather, my point is that the Christian church has become particularly under scrutiny in the new demonic story. If we understand these movies to offer something of cultural significance, then they offer something that's specifically speaking to and in the context of the Christian church. So the second point I'd like to mention is that demonic possession is portrayed as a genuine religious experience that resists traditional modes of religion enshrined by the church. So we have it connected to the church, but then there are ways that these movies kind of accuse the church of being inadequate. Okay? So in a world that's otherwise dominated by modern secularism, demonic possession is depicted in a way that insists the supernatural is valid, powerful, and recognizably religious. The portrayal is predominantly physiological, including bodily contortions, disturbances of normal eating habits, whether that's having like wanting to eat bugs or not being able to eat at all, self-injury, and then visual and auditory hallucinations.
These symptoms locate the betrayed experience well outside Christian devotion as it is commonly practiced and understood. Additionally, when religious help does arrive, it usually comes in the form of a rogue agent, someone who's operating outside the institutional church, like deliver us from evil. He meets that like butt-kicking kind of, you know, ninja priest. The Conjuring, you know, you have the Warrens who then kind of deputize everybody in the house in order, you know, to conduct an exorcism. Even in such cases that the church is officially involved, usually the individual agent is in some way pitted against the overarching institution. So like in the exorcism of Emily Rose, the church endorsed that exorcism, but when the priest goes on trial for his involvement in that exorcism, the diocese is like, shh, we want to shut this up because it's all embarrassing. So in this way, the church is portrayed as doggedly legalistic, embarrassed, bordering on confused, and often ultimately neglectful. Perhaps even more troubling, if these films are suggesting that demonic possession is depicted as genuine religious experience, then the church, even functioning at its potential best, going in and officially exorcising, is seen as antagonistic to real spiritual experiences. Like, the point of the whole point of that confrontation is to shut it down, as they challenge its sincerity and the legitimacy of its authority. Third point, demonic possession most often afflicts women, indicating that there's really nothing the church finds scarier than women's bodies. You know, while the general cultural stereotypes of women may be implicated, considering the strong ties between the demonic narratives and pulp culture perception of the Christian church already discussed, I think it's safe to suggest that the church is perceived to capitulate to, if not intentionally propagate, the myth that women are spiritually naive and more vulnerable than their male counterparts. 9 times out of 10, the person possessed in the most recent exorcism movies is female. Adding to this, the symptoms of possession usually include sexually suggestive or aggressive displays, or are tied to childbirth menstruation. So the new film that just came out, Asmodexia, is just like ripe with that kind of imagery. The Last Exorcism. So exorcism movies are really indicating a public perception that the church is downright horrified by women, confused by sexuality and gender in general, and female sexuality in particular. So how is the church to contend with this kind of criticism? And, like, the first question is, well, should it? And I think just considering, like I said, that there's this wave of these kinds of stories out there now, the church should be concerned with its popular portrayal. It's also that the new demonic narratives seem directed at the church in a way that's noteworthy. However, like I mentioned before, the church has this difficulty of engaging in this kind of talk because you either sound like primitivistic or, resorting to supernaturalism. You know, a lot of the biblical stories of possession have kind of been interpreted away, you know, clinicalized, given this illness outlook. And on the other hand, you have spiritual warfare, which is really implicated with abuse of power. Mark Driscoll, not saying anything about that, but, you know, so it's not being used well in the church when we do use it. So my background is postmodern philosophy of religion, and I think that it's a really great tool, and in fact, this is what I do, is look at these kinds of experiences, to start looking at these fears without necessarily perceiving demons around every corner. The reason why postmodern philosophy of religion is really a great tool for this kind of thing is because it really, you know, it's like Moses and the burning bush. Like, take off your shoes, go no further. Like, postmodern philosophy of religion knows where to stop. I can't describe anything beyond this point. I'm not going to walk farther in than this. And so it kind of gets us out of that sticky part of the conversation, which is, well, are demons, are they really demons, or is it not really demons? Is it a demon? And that's the part that makes us all a little nervous. So we can begin that conversation without necessarily going there. So just 3 points really fast. One, postmodern philosophy of religion allows us to focus on spiritual experiences without pre-validation. Exorcism movements often spend a lot of narrative time on proving that the demonic experience is real, both within the film and to the audience. However, for the purposes of philosophy of religion, this experience recommends itself to be taken seriously. In Prolegomena to Charity, Jean-Luc Marion discusses the logic of evil. He writes, "Evil is experienced as the only indisputable fact, short of all delusion, that is exempt from the need of any proof or argument. If people are having negative spiritual experiences, then it's valuable to evaluate that experience and consider its mechanics and what it means." So, two, postmodern philosophy of religion urges the redress of suffering as a valid spiritual experience. This is along the lines of my first point, but suffering in particular is a self-validating experience and a genuine spiritual experience. American Christianity, it's wed to modern intellectualism, kind of coupled with this rejection of materialist accounts of humanity. It's largely turned its back on the idea of a physical religious experience, especially ones that are negative. Protestant dread results in an expectation of suffering in the experience of God without dealing with the reality that suffering sucks, okay? Suffering is quickly reassigned as positive, having divine purpose, without authentically dwelling with the person suffering. To blame here is also the modern medical urge to treat instead of to be present with. Physical suffering as religious experience has a long history in the Christian tradition. And while I'm by no means in favor, of like returning to flagellation as a form of devotion or anything like that, it's time for the church to acknowledge the reality, long embraced by Eastern religions, that spiritual events have a physiological component, and to commit patiently listening to those who share those experiences, especially when they're negative. And third, I would say, validate and incorporate the spiritual experiences of women. And this is more of an historical argument than a philosophical one, and I applaud efforts that have been made in some quarters, but the fact remains that women's voices and women's experiences are not legitimized by the American church. And given the strong historical correlation between women's spiritual experiences and the physical experiences of religion, if you haven't read Caroline Walker Bynum, on this issue. She's fantastic, talking particularly about medieval women and their physical experience of God. A lot of their experiences, if we take away everything else and just look at the mechanics, look like the experiences of people who experience possession, the changes in appetite and inability to sleep and all those kinds of things. So like, it puts it in a context that makes it understandable. But in order to meet this criticism launched by pop culture conceptions of the demonic, the church needs to reinstate women as leaders within the church, and not leaders for women, not leaders to women, but leaders within the church to lead the church into areas that it's neglected and ignored. You know, I would also bring your attention to the work of ethicist Nell Nodding. In her term ethics of care, there's this assertion that women bring a distinct ethical voice to the community, one that focuses on caring as a virtue, so this listening, being present with. If the church wants to effectively deal with its demons, I would prescribe redrawing the lines of community around historically female religious experiences and embracing women's body as holy, holy, and not under seasonal reproof. Thanks.
Thank you. So, Mikey, you're up next, I think. And do you have a social media handle?
Oh, I have so many.
Which one would you like us to use for your talk?
You can follow me at Physification.
Physification?
Physification.
Awesome.
We're friends.
Okay, cool.
So, I had a conversation with JR this morning.
Sweet.
And I realized that I wasn't going to be the sharpest dressed man here. So when that happened, I fell back on the old adage that you should dress for the job you want, not the job you have. So, and I do want to change gears a little bit here, but hopefully at the end we'll realize we're in the still in the same car, even though we're changing gears, because I want to talk about science fiction, how much I love it. It's a great medium. When we talk about exploring faith themes in film, science fiction allows us to talk about poverty and greed, inequality, division, social structures, the power of technology, the limits of mankind, and basically any other discussion that's worth having, maybe except for supernatural discussions. So where we stay in the same car is that we're still talking about horror movies as well. Horror movies that especially involve ghosts and possessions are incredible ways to directly explore faith through film. I mean, we usually have to ask ourselves after watching a horror film, like, do we believe in another plane of existence? With lots of other, like, lots of other genres, it's kind of like, oh, what's the theme? Are they talking about justice? Are they talking about hate? Are they talking about humanity? But this one, we're often confronted with another plane of existence that we have to say is real. One of my favorite movies from last year was The Conjuring, because at the end of The Conjuring, if you were walking out, you couldn't have missed the fact that they put on screen, like, the devil is real. And you have to deal with that. And that's why I love horror. So when you combine these two, I thought we would get some of the best conversations on faith and film. Unfortunately, it seems like science fiction is kind of afraid to have that discussion. There are just not that many examples of true possession experiences in science fiction. I mean, there are a few, and I'll kind of get to those. But what we seem to have is a science versus supernatural, an either-or. Even Joss Whedon, the new head of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, at least now, put out this statement when he started putting out the Avengers film, and he said, like, in a world of magic and superheroes, we're basically not going to have anything we can't explain with science. You know, so he's dealing with Thor, a god from Asgard, you know, all things like this. He's like, everything's going to be explained by science. And so I just wonder how much easier it would be if we didn't think of these two as separate entities, but maybe took a look and realized that they could work hand in hand. You know, much like many people have arguments about, you know, creationism, evolution, things like this, they don't necessarily have to be at odds, science and religion. So this is the part of the presentation where I hope everyone really likes listening to me say quotes from Star Trek and Doctor Who, because these are two, I think, the most well-established science fiction universes, both through their different narrations running very, very long. But in particular, Star Trek, Captain Picard has always been one of my heroes, a hero for reason, exploration, the sanctity of life in all its forms. So I could always get behind Captain Picard as a child. But the more and more I grew up, the more and more when I would go back and watch series of The Next Generation, I realized that I feel like he's kind of cheating. For a character who is setting out to explore strange new galaxies, to seek out new life and new civilizations, maybe he's not really that excited, because the problem is he's only seeking out life, not unlife or undead, however you want to put it. And so we frame the entire series by completing the argument before we have it. In Season 3, Episode 4, Who Watches the Watchers, there's a malfunction with an observation post that leads to an accident. And through a series of events, the primitive people on this planet start worshiping Picard as a god. This leads to a conversation on the Enterprise between Commander Riker, Jean-Luc Picard, and the chief scientist from the planet. And the chief scientist, Dr. Barron, says, like it or not, we have rekindled the Mentakin's belief in the Overseer. And Riker, almost stunned, says, and are you saying that this belief will eventually become a religion? Dr. Barron then replies, it's inevitable, and without guidance, that religion could degenerate into inquisitions, holy wars, and chaos. I mean, like, that's the obvious thing that's going to happen if they start believing in an overseer. And to that, Picard is not having it. He says, horrifying, horrifying. Not like that's unfortunate, or let's see if we can fix this. Horrifying. Dr. Barron, your report describes how rational these people are. Millennia ago, they abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you're asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear. No, I will not do that. So I think the one piece of this episode that I guess follows through on his beliefs is at the end, Picard is at least willing to die for the Prime Directive, telling the Mentakins that they can kill him and see that he's not a god. But what it already has is set the stage for the argument. Like, there's no place to have that conversation in Star Trek. And furthermore, in Season 4, Episode 13, The Devil's Due, the Enterprise answers a distress call from a planet that claims, after entering a contract that ensured 1,000 years of peace and prosperity, the planet's version of the devil, named Ardra, has come back to take the planet as her own. And one of my favorite things in movies, one of my favorite things in TV shows, is when the writers are able to create a scene at the beginning of a show, and it basically sums up the entire theme of the episode, so you can keep watching for that the entire episode. And this episode, even though it deals with a devil creature and this contract and most of the card, it starts with Data on the holodeck, like most episodes do, actually. And he's reciting this piece from a Christmas Carol when Jacob Marley shows up to him and asks him why he doubts his senses. And Lieutenant Commander Data, as Scrooge, says, because a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheats. You may be a bit of undigested beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. Why, there's more of gravy than of grave tea about you, whatever you are. Humbug, I tell you, humbug. And so we see from there, the writers have already set a stage that says, when you come up against supernatural elements, there's a whole lot of explanations for them that make better explanations than that there is a supernatural presence or ghosts, anything like that. Because that's all we get from the Christmas Carol. We could have gotten so many more things that in the Christmas Carol that actually do back up ghosts. And so when they finally confront each other, Ardra says to Picard, "I pity you. We live in a universe of magic, which evidently you cannot see." Unfortunately, this line is given by our antagonist, who ends up being a con artist. The cheat in this episode is that Picard also says to Geordi LaForge, "My reputation as a litigator, not to mention my immortal soul, is in serious jeopardy." Picard referring to his immortal soul when he's already claimed that there is no such thing. But the big idea here, and the reason that I mentioned this episode in framing what Star Trek thinks, is that Picard has an utter disbelief for the supernatural and a love only for the naturalistic. If it can't be explained through natural means, then it's not worth explaining. Because after this huge trial goes on and he disproves that this was a con artist, not really the devil coming back to claim his contract, one of the planet's inhabitants say, "Thank you, Captain Picard, you saved our lives." And Picard emphatically says, "No, as I've tried to tell you, you saved your own lives a long time ago." So with that framework, we see that anytime we see a ghost or anything in Star Trek, The Next Generation specifically, there's an episode, Season 5, Episode 15, Power Play, when Data, Troy, and O'Brien get possessed by what appear to be spirits from a crashed Federation ship. Nope, aliens. And we never had a doubt for a minute. And another episode called The Next Phase, Geordi LaForge and Ensign Ro are in an accident, and they're phased through a phasing cloaking device, technical thing. And the crew, actually for a little while, almost wrestles with the possibility of ghosts. Some people talk about their backgrounds, their history, what their planets believed, but ultimately, they weren't ghosts. They were just phased. Of course they were. I mean, because we can't have, like I said, supernatural in a science fiction show. So that was pretty depressing for a show that's been so influential. And Doctor Who, I love, not as much as my wife does, or maybe anyone does as much as my wife, I feel like he's being dishonest as well. There's an episode, Season 4, Episode 10, called Midnight, and the Doctor goes for a bus tour to the Sapphire Waterfalls, a planet where everything's beautiful, but life can't exist on the surface. In the middle of this bus ride, the bus breaks down, and there's a mysterious knocking on the outside, and everyone's really afraid. Like, what is this? What is this? Oh, what's going on? Nothing can survive on the surface. And there's a professor and says, it can't be there. You know, life can't exist out there. And the doctor, who is later going to cheat, says, "Professor, I'm glad you have an absolute definition of life in the universe, but perhaps the universe has ideas of its own." Which I was very, very encouraged to hear, because I'm okay, that's going to open his mind later in the season. He's going to run across some things. We may actually get a supernatural occurrence, but in one of the most glaring ones, episodes, or two-part episode, The Impossible Planet, which is the precursor of The Satan Pit, we see the Doctor and Rose land on a planet,
and they immediately run across language that the TARDIS can translate. And for those of you who aren't Doctor Who fans, the TARDIS can translate any language that's ever existed. So immediately the Doctor says, oh, must mean this writing is very old. You know, red flags. Lots of creatures in this episode become possessed, and they say things like, we are the Legion of the Beast. The Legion shall be many, and the Legion shall be free. He has woven himself into the fabric of your life since the dawn of time. Some may call him Abaddon. Some may call him Croptor. Some may call him Satan or Lucifer or the King of Despair, the Deathless Prince, the Bringer of Night. And these are the words that shall set him free. So on and on, we have examples of this. And I think I wrote like two pages of just from these two episodes of things that they refer to him as. But the Doctor eventually confronts him and he says, if you are the Beast, then answer me this. Which one? Because the universe has been busy since you've been gone. There's more religions than there are planets in the sky. There's the Archifets, Christianity, Pash-Pash, New Judaism, Sanclar, Church of the Ten Vagabond. Which devil are you? And the Beast says, all of them. And the Doctor says, well, how did you end up on this rock? And the Beast says, the Disciples of Light rose up against me and chained me in the pit for all eternity. Doctor, when was this? Before time. What does before time mean? Before time and light and space and matter, before the cataclysm, before the universe was created. And the Doctor says, that's impossible. No life could have existed back then. And the Beast says, is that your religion? Doctor simply replies, it's a belief. And once the story goes on and the episode is wrapped up, the Doctor actually says that his big hang-up was that if the thing had said it was from beyond the universe, he'd have believed it. But before, impossible. So we see that the Doctor also basically has a set of rules that dictate what can and can't happen in the universe. He doesn't choose to try to prove these things. He doesn't try to explore them. He basically says, this is what I believe, and this is what can and can't happen. And given he's really smart, he's set up as a character who knows more about almost everything than anybody, but he still has his rules. And that frames everything else. We have an episode of The Unquiet Dead. Spirits begin possessing bodies of the recently deceased in Cardiff. Because why wouldn't, you know, things happen in London? Well, not London, but England. And it was a great adventure with Charles Dickens. But the Doctor explains it away. A weak point in time and space, a connection between this place and another, that's the cause of ghost stories most of the time. And it ends up, they were aliens. Of course, because they can't be spirits. In Army of Ghosts, in Season 2, ghosts of deceased loved ones begin to show up. It's really just ripping space into a parallel dimension. Not ghosts. In episode Hyde from a recent season, the manor house where there's a team of paranormal investigators checking into a haunting, but it's really just a traveler trapped in a pocket dimension, not a ghost. So there are a few things in sci-fi that actually give us something to work with. In the remake of Battlestar Galactica, we have a religion that is not only prevalent, but it's central in the theme of the entire story. And so this would give us so many opportunities to explore the supernatural. Mainly they stick to talking about personal belief and fate. And even when Kara Starbuck Thrace, the hotshot pilot, flies her ship into a white light and it's seen blowing up, and then she magically shows up 2 months later, no one asks, is this a ghost? Has she been possessed by something? They just assume she's a Cylon. They could have really gone somewhere with that, but they chose not to because, like I said, those things are at odds. So I could find two examples of where science fiction has really tried to gauge the story of the paranormal. And that was in a movie that I couldn't watch because apparently it was so bad, it only exists on VHS. That movie is called The Dark Side of the Moon. It came out in 1990. And there's a malevolent force on the other side of the moon trying to possess people and kill them. We find out that it was actually Satan. He was banished to the Bermuda Triangle by God, like where, you know, because where else would you send the devil? And so he keeps hopping between the Bermuda Triangle and the dark side of the moon, waiting to feast on people's souls. I guess that makes sense. I'd say the best example we have, and it's still not perfect, is a movie called Event Horizon. When you say horror or possession in science fiction, the first thing that pops up on a Google search, the first thing that most people will say to you is Event Horizon. And this is a great movie. So there's a group of astronauts that are sent to the far side of the solar system to investigate a distress signal from a ship that disappeared and has been missing for 7 years. Once they arrive, they find that the ship with an experimental drive system may have gone beyond the known universe, and even worse, it could have brought something back. So this is a great opportunity for them to fall in line with everyone else. Aliens, you know, imprints, psychic imprints of people who were alive before. But no, they start decoding the messages, and the messages from the Event Horizon were save yourself from hell. And they never get off of that. We get possession, we get visions of horrible, horrible things happening. And ultimately, we get people saying the ship brought itself back. I told you she wouldn't leave. She won't let anyone leave. Do you really think you could destroy this ship? And ultimately, when someone says, where did it come from or where did it go? Was it hell? He said, you know nothing. Hell is only a word. The reality is much, much worse. So the biggest thing that this movie does is that it doesn't explain away or explain hell or the supernatural out of existence. It explains the supernatural into existence. And that's something that very few science fiction things do. Because of that, I think this is an untapped genre. And I also would argue that science and the supernatural don't have to fight. They don't have to be either or. So the last thing I'll leave you with is when I was doing... I was searching and searching for examples that would prove me wrong, that would have real, true discussion. And I stumbled upon an article at moviepilot.com by Rick Romanowski. And to end his... He had frustration, too. He's like, where are all these movies? This is such a great genre. Where are all these movies? Why are people not, you know, digging into this? He ended it by saying, I can't help but bring up the infamous introductory line from the Star Trek series, space, the final frontier. Perhaps we should take a lesson from this.
And yes, to all of those of you who are wondering, I was named after a character in Doctor Who, very intentionally. I can't take any credit for it, though. So I'm super excited to hear JR speak, and those of you who are around Baylor will be excited to know that he has agreed to come back and speak at Baylor about superheroes next term, which I'm very pumped about. So he's going to come to my class, but it'll be an open class, and we'll also have a reception for him in the HRC.
That sounds fun. All right, I'm going to keep this short so we have time to discuss, because I'm sure everyone has some questions, and I have some questions for my fellow panelists. I was raised in the evangelical church, and I also had a fascination with the occult and horror, vampires, werewolves. I actually found a Ouija board at my grandma's house one time and thought my mom was going to have a stroke when I brought it out. I was like, this looks like a fun game. And she's like, ah! Which, of course, just made me want to play it more. And what I find fascinating now in retrospect was that, as a rule, I don't think it's breaking any new ground to say that most evangelical churches totally eschew horror films. They say, don't touch them, don't mess with them, stay away. But even among those who will tolerate a slasher flick or some torture porn or a monster film, the one genre that is still very much off limits is the demonic, right? Any films about specifically evil spirits, and you hear all kinds of things like you're opening yourself up to being influenced by them, or you know what's wrong with you that you would be interested in something like that. The evangelical attitude towards these kinds of stories has largely looked like postures of critique and condemnation. And what I would like to argue is that Christians ought to take seriously the popularity and pervasiveness of these stories. We ought to engage them, to listen to them, and to learn from them. But we shouldn't do that merely as stories of supernatural possession. Rather, the demonic offer us a unique window into the spiritual condition of our culture. So it's good to ask the question, what is a monster? What is it good for? What do they do? Why are monster stories so popular, so pervasive? So I'm following Scott Poole, whose excellent book, Monsters in America, is out at the book table. If you are fascinated by monsters at all, it's a pretty challenging read, but it's just fantastic. And he says
that monsters are manifestations of the dark underbelly of the American dream. So I'm going to quote from his introduction. Scott says, "The story of American monsters and how they obsess American culture allows us to look at the underground history of the United States. The monster reifies very real incidents, true horrors, true monsters. This is why they are always complicated and inherently sophisticated. The monster has its tentacles wrapped around the foundations of American history. It draws its life from ideological efforts to marginalize the weak and normalize the powerful, to suppress struggles for class, racial, and sexual liberation, to transform the American way of life," in quotes, "into a weapon of empire." So, I want to ask, what do the stories of demonic possession point us to? What values and identities are they critiquing? Bryn already did an excellent job of exploring issues of female identity, so I want to actually take the one film out of ten and explore two films that particularly critique American notions of male identity. So how many of you have seen Sinister? A few of you? Good. What about Deliver Us from Evil? Came out this year. Okay, both of them are Scott Derrickson films. I love Scott Derrickson. He's doing the new Doctor Strange movie, which is the Marvel version of the demonic, so it'll be interesting to see how he plays into Whedon's overall. So both of these films, Sinister and Deliver Us from Evil, provide unique windows into American anxiety about male identity. The 2012 film Sinister tells the story of a true crime author named Ellison Oswald, who is still living off of the success of his decades-old debut book, and he just hasn't been able to recreate the magic of that first book. And the film actually opens with him giving an interview talking about something he wrote 20 years ago. And you can kind of feel the anxiety that he has about you know, how much longer can he live off the fumes of this success? What is he going to have to do to create something else? And so what he does is move his family, his wife and his two children, into a house that is the site of a locally famous mass murder. A family was murdered in this house, and the 10-year-old daughter went missing, and that was never solved. No one ever found out who murdered them, and so he figures he's going to move his family into this house and solve the murder, and that's going to be his new success. His family won't have to worry about money anymore, and they'll be taken care of. Shockingly, this shoot proves to be a bad idea. Ellison eventually discovers a demon named Bagul slaughters families by possessing one of the children and then taking the child into his demonic realm and consuming their soul. And so Ellison actually discovers this too late to save his daughter Ashley from possession. And the film ends with Ashley murdering her family and then being while being possessed by Bagul and then being taken by him into the underworld, apparently to be consumed. So it's a good family film. Derrickson's next film was this year's Deliver Us from Evil, and it features a story of an actual police sergeant named Ralph Sarchi. Now, despite the fact that the film is allegedly based on Sarchi's 2001 memoir called Beware the Night, and in a lot of the advertising it said inspired by true events, it's interesting that the film is not based on a story that's in Sarchi's memoir. It's actually an original story created by Derrickson and his co-writer, Paul Harris Boardman. So in Deliver Us from Evil, Detective Sarchi, I think he's a detective, he becomes convinced of the reality of the demonic when he's investigating two seemingly unrelated cases. One is a case of domestic abuse. One is a case of almost child abuse. And ultimately, he discovers that the cases are linked by an Army veteran named Santino, who was possessed while he was deployed in Iraq. Sarchi and a priest named Mendoza, who Brandon mentioned earlier, is kind of the ninja priest, right? They exorcise Santino and become sort of, they end up at the end of the film becoming sort of a supernatural crime-fighting duo. Now, what do those films tell us? Well, according to Poole, remember, monsters are an opportunity for us to examine the underbelly of the American dream. They're a window through which we can examine how our cultural values and identity dehumanize certain members of our own culture, to say nothing of people that we would consider other. So within these two Derrickson films, which show the monstrous underbelly of what I would say is like traditional American manhood, both films present men in traditionally laudable roles, the breadwinner in Sinister and the soldier in Deliver Us from Evil. But in both stories, these traditional male roles do not bring life to the people around them and to the person involved, but actually suffering. In Sinister, though Ellison's daughter is the one who is possessed and her soul is consumed. It's Ellison's extreme, we would almost maybe call it maniacal dedication to recapturing his career, is what actually directly causes her destruction and the destruction of the whole family. So Sinister functions as a sort of morality play in which Ellison's commitments to, we could say, providing a life for his family is revealed to be an evil choice. His commitment to his work invites an actual demonic presence into their lives, and ultimately his commitment to bring life brings his family death. So in the world of the 80-hour work weeks, the father who sacrifices his family on the altar of work has become something almost cliché. And yet it seems that we are more comfortable attributing the devastating effects of this sort of achievement-oriented, hyper-masculinistic culture and parenting to a Babylonian demon god than acknowledging that we might be complicit in forming children whose identity is centered on achievement. Similarly, Deliver Us From Evil shows us a man, Santino, who is deployed and comes home as a monster. Again, the massive mental, emotional, and physical disabilities that plague veterans of our armed forces are as well documented as they are ignored. And yet, we would rather attribute the violence of our returning soldiers to demons than admit that the way America acts in the world creates conditions under which our young men and women become less than human. We would rather blame spooks and spirits than face that we are complicit in the American war machine that consumes and discards our youth as so much excrement. So, our values often are what actually create the conditions under which people are transformed into monsters. We can choose to blame it on spirits and spooks if we want, or we can take a hard look at ourselves and ask how we are actually contributing to these things. And so I would suggest that the church particularly has two options when it comes to responding to demon stories. We can ignore the films, either by completely eschewing them, as I was repeatedly advised in my youth to do, or also just by accepting them at face value as nothing more than a ghost story. The other option that we have is to listen to these films and acknowledge the deep-seated anxieties that they tell us about our cultures. And we can ask the degree to which our churches participate in and perpetuate those death-bringing attitudes and values, or the degree to which the church can choose to be a prophetic voice and stand up against those things. Obviously, I would choose the latter. And I would say that is probably the healthiest response to this new wave of demon popularity that I can conceive of as a person, as a pastor, as a thinker. So with that, that's all I've got. Let's ask some questions. What are you saying?
All right. Thank you. The good news is we have tons of time for discussion, and we want to hear from you, too, like comments, feedback, ideas, questions. I'm going to... throw in a first question just to get us going to all our panelists. And I would ask, from your varying perspectives, you know, JR sort of launched us on this track already. What do you think that, for us as audience members here and people who are interested in this discussion, what to you is the most important question we should be asking as participants in modern culture that this kind of, these kind of ideas and movies invite us into? And feel free to take it in any order you want. So, where should we start if we're just getting interested in this for the first time and we don't have the kind of expertise you have? What's the big question we should be looking to answer?
I think, for me, the big question is sort of what's at stake, right? I mean, as Bryn was pointing out, and I'll say this as a pastor, as someone who's sort of paid to have all the answers, when you get into a situation where they're maybe something demonic happening, it creates a tremendous amount of anxiety, and I'm relatively skeptical of people who claim that they can easily discern one way or the other. Actually, when Clay and I were doing some research for his newest book that he's working on, we visited the original archives in St. Louis where the actual case that the Exorcist film is based on occurred, and we met the guy who's in charge of the archives for all of that material. And one of the things he told us was that the two priests who were involved in it, who spent months performing exorcisms and working with the boy who was possibly possessed, one of the priests actually at the end of it all did not believe it was actual demonic possession, and the other one was 50-50 split on whether it was or not. That is not the impression I received from the Exorcist film, even a little bit, right? But that was a real gut check to me that, like, wow, even one of the denominations that in my mind is like the most well positioned to respond to exorcism does so with a great deal of skepticism and care. And so I would say that, and Bryn actually talks about this a lot, so she'll probably riff off this, but when you see cases of possession, there's often a lot of dehumanization that happens and a lot of behavior, a lot of the ways that the possessed is treated by their caregivers or by the exorcists is very dehumanizing, and it's sort of made okay because now they're a monster, they're not a person, they've been taken over by this monster, and so anything we do to them, as long as it ends, we hope, with a successful exorcism, is somehow justified. And I would say that can't be okay. Like, again, particularly as a Christian, I would say even the way we treat our enemies is reveals how we are faithful disciples or not. And I would think that would at least extend to people who are possessed by some sort of spiritual enemy. Again, maybe, because there's a huge asterisk by that. So for me, it would be like that. What's at stake? Like, and how are we responding to these potential cases? And how are we really looking at what's beneath the surface?
And JR's on Twitter at JR Forresteros. If you're on the back feed, I know some of you are, like you've seen the tweets under the hashtag with his address too.
I would build on that too. Another interview I did up in Erie, Pennsylvania was with a Protestant exorcist. You don't find a great many of them, so I was very willing to drive and spend a Sunday afternoon with him. And his background is as a counselor. He has a background in the psychological reality. And he said that by and large, most reported cases of possession are about mental health. And he's very concerned as well, although we do acknowledge supernatural realities. You know, as people of faith, he's very concerned that too often that it's not being approached properly. And there's always an issue that needs to be dealt with. So yeah, very, very important what he told me that day, what you echoed in your talk, not to be looking for a demon behind every bush. Because sometimes that seems to be what people are looking to do. Like, well, something spooky happens, must be demonic or something. And there are, as you said, people's health is at stake.
Yeah, and you know, and I think about that, especially, we're like divided in the Scott Derrickson fan club here, because I'm not a big fan of Scott Derrickson. But this is an argument we've had before. But yeah. I think that's what we're arguing about, whether I'm wrong or not. I think that, you know, like sometimes there's a tendency in faith communities to kind of be triumphalist with these presentations of a picture that suggests that the supernatural is real. Like, you know, because we're living in a secular world. A lot of the narratives reinforce a secular outlook, and so a movie comes along and, you know, suggests to audiences that the supernatural is real. And I mean, the problem that I have with Scott Derrickson is that he presents that to you in a way that makes that reality horrific. Like, okay, it's real, but like the picture he's painted of that is highly problematic. So I think, like, taking a step back and before there's any kind of rejoicing in the faith community department over these narratives are being presented, and that's significant because now the supernatural is real. Well, what kind of supernatural, like what kind of picture of God results from this suggestion that the supernatural is real? Like, what's the cost of me endorsing this picture that's been painted? And I think also, like what Clay and also JR was saying, because I study this sort of thing, like I Google alert exorcism, I Google alert demon, so I get it like a news feed, a supernatural news feed.
It's
and
for fun.
And there's, well, unfortunately it's not. It's like intensely tragic. Like there's not a week that goes by that I don't get an article where someone was injured in the course of an exorcism. And they're most often children. Like UNICEF has put out many reports regarding children being accused of witchcraft, and it's like a public health problem, and so again, it's this question of like, oh, well, this is, you know, like, this is a niche market for religion. I mean, that's the premise for The Last Exorcist, the first movie, not the second. We're just going to stay with the first. So, you know, is that he's an exorcist, and he's doing it, even though he's lost his own faith, he's doing it because it helps people, you know? And then he comes to the realization that there are children being harmed in this, and so I need to expose this for what it is, because there are children being harmed. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, something to be aware of, like, you know, there's a suggestion that the supernatural is real, but, like, what kind of reality are we being handed in that case? So.
And just to be clear, you were talking about the first Last Exorcism, not the last Exorcism?
I was talking about the first, yeah. The first Last Exorcism, yeah, okay. Yes.
Well, so, SJ, when you ask the question, like, people who are not used to doing kind of the things that we've been doing for a while now as a panel, how would they begin to engage? I would say the first thing that I would suggest is to do exactly what JR ended his piece with, and not simply just take a movie for face value. And the way that I interact with horror films is the way that I interact with most films. When I get done, I don't just simply say, that was good, or that kind of stung. I ask why. So we turn our brains on. Because whether we want them to or not, these films are teaching us something. Mm-hmm. They're telling us something about how we think. And especially if we don't critically look, like the rest of the panel's talking about, at some of these supernatural versus non-supernatural elements, we're just assuming that it's okay that these things are happening to children. So what I started by doing is what I do on my podcast when I have a guest on, to get conversation started, because you can't always just jump right in, like, what did you really feel like the theological theme and implication of this film was? But you can start by saying, did you enjoy it? And the beauty of that question is, whether they say I hated it or whether they said I loved it, there's a follow-up question, why? And you just keep going down that path until you realize what's really bothering people or what's really connecting with people. And I think with horror specifically, when you start asking why, you're going to get some really good answers.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's a great time to remind you, if you have not read Simon Sinek's book about Talk to Why, I really recommend it. It'll change your way of doing research, engaging your students, and engaging any question, like, for the general public. We always care about why more than we care about want as human beings.
Can you repeat the name of that?
Yes, Simon Sinek, S-I-N-E-K. And I think it's called Talk to Why, right? Is mm-hmm. it?
If you search Simon Sinek, why,
yeah.
It'll come up.
It's really, really good.
He has a TED Talk on it, too.
Mm-hmm, he does. I really recommend it. And it's a great place for you to, if you're thinking about, hey, how do I do what these guys do, and cross over and talk to the general public about these important issues in my research, why is going to always be the place to begin. That's what people are passionate about. You know, a little plug for your love of stories here. We're 22 times more likely to remember a story than a fact. Period.
That's all Jesus did.
Yeah, that's why the Aeneid, the Bible, you know, all these great cultural icons are still around. They told stories and they cared about why. And they didn't tell us what was. We get to the what by asking the why, right? On that note, I also recommend Clay Morgan's book, I'm Dead. You can get it out of the bookstore. It's sitting up here. That's what it looks like. My students, like, inhaled it this semester.
Literally?
And with that, like, what questions do you guys have to follow up here? Mm-hmm. I can keep asking them questions all day. Or maybe we'll ask you all a question. Like, why are you here? Why does this topic fascinate you?
I have a specific question about Sinister, and I appreciate what you shared about the story and the vision of the Ethan Hawke as the breadwinner and things, but I kind of, when I saw the movie, I thought we were catching the story on a path, because at the very end, the videotapes, all that stuff is back in the attic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Somebody else is going to be drawn in because there are Sinister many, many victims. So something got that family to find that, discover that, have them come in, the kids. So this was a story along the line mm-hmm. of some kind of, like, urban legend or tale mm-hmm. or something. So I don't know if that that takes away from what you were saying about the...
I think we'll find out when Sinister 2 comes out, which Derrickson is filming right now. So, I mean, but that depends, right? We'll have to see. I mean, in that standalone film, you get very little mythology about Bagul and why he's doing this. And all you know about these families is that it's not until they move out of the house and move into the next house that the murders happen. Like, that's the only...
Yeah, I just wonder
so,
if the takeaway is, not to push so much for achievement and trying to find success, as in, don't open anything you find in the attic of the house.
never move. It's hard for me to get away from the ambition angle. You've got the creepy plot device, but the way the film, when you're evaluating film, pay attention to that first scene, right? Like that says that's an important scene. And other than the creepy murder thing that you're getting at the beginning of the horror story, like the introduction to the main character is he's on this interview, about this book that he wrote 20 years ago. So I mean that really sets up this is who this guy is, and every decision he makes in the film is around success, which is such a that's such a quintessential American value, right? Like, it's like, achieve, achieve, achieve. And again, maybe when Sinister 2 comes out, it'll reframe all of that. Maybe it'll go in a different direction. We don't know. Maybe by next year we'll be able to have that conversation. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, I guess to me the idea of critiquing the American idea of a success is scarier than don't open something you find in the attic, though that's certainly good advice.
Right. Well, that's like I haven't seen it yet, but it's out. The Inner Demons movie. And, like, basically, it's a found footage film, but they subverted a little bit. So they're supposed to be shooting this, like, reality TV show kind of thing around a good Catholic girl who has suddenly gone horribly wrong. And so they're confronting her because she has a drug problem. And as the movie unfolds, it finds out, like, she was medicating this demonic possession. And it's like, I saw that, and I'm like that's the reason we can come up with for this girl going bad. Like, it's easier for us to say, see, it was demonic, that's why she has a drug problem, than it is for us to, like, accept that, no, like, there are other things that could be driving that, a disappointment with her upbringing, the emptiness of what she thinks is her family values, like, those things are scarier than the demon. Those things are scarier. So, like this idea that kind of ambition breadwinning thing doesn't, is not as good as we thought it was. Like, in some sense, that's scarier than
a box you find in the attic.
A box you find in the attic and, like the scary film. So,
yeah, I just want to, like, jump in and vouch for, like, what these guys are saying from a critic's perspective. If you're ever wondering, yeah, but do screenwriters and producers really care that much about the opening scene? Absolutely. In Hollywood, we can predict whether your movie or novel will be successful based on the first 3 pages, the first 3 minutes of a script. And I can guarantee you, as a longtime reader for studios, for greenwriting projects or not, before I became a screenwriter, that nobody will read beyond the first page of your script if the first page of your script does not hit certain emotional impact factors. And if I don't know by the end of the first page, which is 1 minute on screen, if the movie's going to go somewhere. So your major test points for looking at a script, or if you're working on a project, are page 1, page 3, page 5, page 10. If you make it to that, it will only guarantee that a reader will take you up to page 25. And if you get to page 50, they'll probably read the whole thing. But you will literally not get read beyond page 1 if the emotional impact isn't there. Why? Andrew Stanton talks about this a lot. Stories are supposed to make us care. We know more before than anything else about story research and the way it impacts our brain. And the idea is that, like, yes, screenwriters are really thinking about this. Story design is an important part of their process. So when they say, hey, look at the opening scene, we're all taught in school that opening 3 pages better not only introduce you well to the character, it better not only really set up your plot, it better not only set up what's at stake in the world, it also better reveal to us a weakness, an inadequacy that the movie's going to have to deal with. And if you want to see that really well at work, look no farther than the opening scene of the original Star Wars, right? You know everything about where that movie's going to end from the opening scene, and it's going to be really hard to get there. And the movie's job is to cause you to wrestle with the fact with, holy crap, like, I sort of thought it was going to go this way and the rebellion was going to win, but maybe they can't! The stakes have to get that high. So in a horror movie, the loss of the soul and the ability of the demonic to win out has to be so palpable and so real that it needs to also be guided by this inner struggle of the character. And we need to sort of see all of that, you're absolutely right, in the opening 3 minutes of the film. So they're right on target here, and the critics are really matching up with what we are doing when we confront the blank page and write these stories. Yeah.
So what do you see the benefit of this genre, this demonic, the possession stuff? I feel like the way that you guys have been talking about it is more of in some metaphor. There's some, as opposed to looking at it as this is reality, it seems like, is there a better way to look at it than this is like what demon possession looks like, or more as like what JR is saying, I know that you can look at it both ways, but what?
Well, I would say a problem with looking at films about possession as portrayals of reality is that they're not. I mean, and again, in Beware the Night, you had a whole book full of stories of encounters of the demonic by this, again, ostensibly they're real, right? It was published as a memoir, and yet when Derrickson decided to make a movie about this guy's life, he chose to make up a new story instead of telling one they already had. If any of you were at Bryn's paper yesterday on The Exorcism of Emily Rose, he took a lot of liberties with, a true case of events that actually happened. He transformed them until they were nearly unrecognizable from the original plot. I think The Conjuring was something similar, where you have real people, Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are demonologists or whatever, and yet the Conjuring is not based on one of their actual cases. It's based on... It's like, oh, man... What these guys did was pretty awesome, but you know what would be even more awesome? Like a ghost or a deep. So I mean, part of the problem is there. Like when we're sitting in a cinema or popping something in on Halloween night to watch at home, we're not watching documentaries. We're watching stories that storytellers in our culture have decided would be interesting, and that people all through the studio process said, yeah, this will resonate well enough to get out our rake and bring in some greenbacks, right? And so, like, I think more profitable for us as critics, and I would say even, again, as people who care about this from a spiritual perspective, is why did they choose to tell this story? Why did they choose to tell it in this way? And why is it resonating so well? What is it about this that's getting people so excited? Now, if we had a documentary where they just had a camera on a tripod during an exorcism, then we'd have a different conversation. But that's not what these stories are. And so you get into dangerous waters if you buy hook, line, and sinker into, it says it's inspired by true events. That means I'm basically getting a documentary presentation.
They're all inspired by true events.
Yeah, right, yeah. So,
I mean, every single one of them says that.
There's an article on Screen Crush that says... like the 10 movies that you think are based on true events but really aren't. I was just reading it, and I think it's fascinating, right? Like, you don't go... Obviously, you're not going to go to a Marvel movie and see based on true... inspired by true...
Right.
And honestly, with a drama, every once in a while you got one of those like Channing Tatum movies, and they'd be like, oh, The Vow, that really happened. But, two people fell in love and one got sick. But when you look specifically at paranormal films, they want to put that tag on there... because they want to at least get you. It's interesting in this genre in particular. How many times they're going to find any way to say this is close to something that happened once? Because then you're like, really?
And we're taught to do that, like in screenwriting school. Like you're taught to do that for the horror genre, for anything that relates to experience that could be real. And the gap comes from confronting the difference between what is real and what's not. We're literally told, this is a great opportunity to say. Based on true events.
And then there's the Coen brothers in Fargo who just literally made the whole thing up and just put that on the screen to see what it would do.
Yeah.
Not one bit of it's true. And then the TV show on FX did the same thing.
Yeah.
Based on true events. The first thing you see every day and you're like, I can't believe this happened.
Yeah. It did.
There's a reason you can't believe it.
Right. Yeah. That's not unlike Blair Witch Project. Right.
Blair Witch, nobody knew what the truth was.
You know, and I had so many people arguing with me like, oh no, it's real. It's real. I'm like, hey, it's not real.
And writers have been doing this for thousands of years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we can go back thousands of years ago, and people are running around saying, I find this book in a cupboard. It is very, very old.
Alexander
it's based
Willis.
On the true account of what really happened, and Homer got it wrong. Right. And mine was an eyewitness event, so my story is true.
Tell ghost stories around a campfire.
Right.
You never tell little kids that it didn't. It's like, don't worry, this didn't happen. Yeah. I'm going to scare you a lot. Yeah. Right. It's like, did you ever hear the tale of the man with the hook hand?
About to ruin your night.
Yeah. And they never caught him.
That actually did happen to a cousin's friend of mine.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Someone who I know that actually, yeah. Happened to
friend of a cousin.
In my talk yesterday, I talked a lot about this movie Requiem, which is a German film, and I think as far as kind of realistic portrayals, or at least an ambivalent portrayal, or a portrayal of this kind of religious experience that allows us to kind of ask these kinds of questions and deal with that ambiguity and deal with the, so what are you saying to me about this kind of experience? First of all, it's a beautiful film. It's visually gorgeous. The dialogue is in German, but the interchanges are so just gripping and compelling, and it's done very starkly. There's not a sensationalist element in the story, but it really lays out, like, this is her experience and kind of couches that either way. Her personal struggle with how do I understand what's happening to me? Do I understand it through medicine and science, or do I understand it through my religious background? And she just flip-flops, and you flip-flop with her through the whole movie. So it's really a mm-hmm. film that's very, very profitable for asking those kinds of questions and asking real questions about what could this really look like, and what would really be at stake in those moments.
I would say if someone vomits pea soup at you, that's when you
when
you run and get a priest.
Yeah, that's hers.
Unless you're watching Pitch Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I'd also say, even though you want to realize that it's not real, despite the screenwriter's claim, just as much as you wouldn't want to dismiss the film or say, oh, that's nice, you also don't want to take everything a film says at face value.
If you do see through the first layer, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you ask why. Continue to ask yourself, what is it about this that does frighten me?
Right. Yeah. Filmmakers have an agenda. They have prior belief commitments that come through the film. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we all bring something to it, whether we're talking about a text or we're talking about a film. I mean, if it's written by a human being, they're coming from a particular perspective. I just totally outed myself as thoroughly postmodern by saying that. So at any time, they're coming from a particular perspective. So it's always a good kind of reflex when you're interacting with a narrative to say, okay, so what are their presuppositions that they're bringing to this project, and how did that influence the way they told this story? Because the authors are present in the, and their belief systems are present in that work. So even once you get through the account isn't factual, they're, it's being told in a particular way because it's being told by a particular storyteller.
Yeah, you'd be surprised where we get our based on true events. Recently, I had this really bad restaurant experience. The restaurant will remain unnamed. You were asking, where'd you get this idea? I didn't tell you yesterday. So I had this really bad restaurant experience that I took a friend from New York who was visiting to a brand new restaurant in Austin that had been getting rave reviews. And it's in this creepy old house that's being redone, sort of in the middle of nowhere. And it was like the worst restaurant experience of my life. And the problem if you have a screenwriter to dinner and things go poorly is that they will not leave you a bad review on Yelp. However, they will write about you in some way. And so now, this is like based on true events. Inspired by that, I'm now designing a new horror story. It'll be my first horror story, whereby, the restaurant is like this locus of evil things that have happened in the past that are linked to the slave trade, and that gets unlocked during the restoration of the restaurant, which, of course, in my mind explains why my meal experience was so bad. But it won't play out like that at all on screen. However, when you see it appear, and keep in mind, too, we design these things very carefully. The average age of a story from the draft existing to it making it out in theaters is 13 years. So as a screenwriter, you have a very short shelf life for your writing life. You have to, like, nail a lot of projects up front and then watch them come out over 40 years, really. So we're very careful about the projects we pick. We're very careful about how we design them.
So when you see this come out, you can bet you it's going to say based on true events right at the beginning. That I can guarantee you.
Probably got time for one more question. Anyone else?
I just wanted to know the name of the medieval, or the woman who wrote about women's spiritual...
Caroline Walker Bynum, B-Y-N-U-M. I think, is the book called Fragmentation and Redemption?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Fragmentation and Redemption. Fantastic book, and really goes through how, you know, women who wanted to pursue a religious career, a career within religious institutions, in medieval Europe, you know, they couldn't be priests or, you know, a lot of those kind of, those were all male kinds of things. And the intellectual side, the theological side of religious devotion was dominated by men. Like, women were excluded from that. And so it's women began to understand their experiences in more mystical ways and in more physical ways, which was kind of like an area that they were left alone to occupy. And it also has to do with, you know, problems with culture and the perception of women's bodies and all of that kind of thing. But so it's kind of this area that women expanded into, you know. I think, you know, reading someone like Julian of Norwich, who has a very physical understanding of her experience of God and suffering. I mean, that's an amazing thing. Like, you have this account from Julian of Norwich, and if you strip it all, like, if you just strip it down to the mechanics of what she experiences, they're not unlike some of these portrayals we're getting of negative spiritual experiences. If we strip them down, they're... But she interpreted it positively, like she had this positive context. I think it's a really interesting... We have the tools to talk about these things. We just haven't been talking about them. Like, there's a reason why we don't have kind of modern narratives that look like that, because we like religion from here up, right? You know, not from here down. So, so it's this kind of reawakening of... But, yeah, Bynum is a historian... And she really puts her finger on these trends going forward.
Several of us are in a civil discourse class at Oklahoma Baptist University, and I just had a question on, like, both as representatives of the church, but then also as members of the, like, culture that we live in, how would you recommend, like, engaging in fruitful, like, discussions on this topic, like, people all across the board? Like, what would you recommend are, like, good starting points, like good points of advice, like where people don't shut down on the topic or it doesn't get too fanatical, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to go quick, but first off, I think you have to be willing to listen to the other side. No matter what the debate is, you have to be open to not just giving lip service to the other argument, but you have to really be willing to understand where all the perspectives are coming from. And you have to be objectively seeking truth, not just bringing all of your own assumptions to it.
Mm-hmm. I think, too... you know, particularly discussing a horror film, you don't have to bring this. You don't have to bring faith matters into it until fairly late in the game. You can start with okay, so this is a demon story, but what's it really about? Like, what's it critiquing? If you take follow Scott Poole's methodology and say, you know, I've heard that monster stories are really about kind of the ugly underbelly of the American dream. Like, what do you think that's critiquing here? Because that's not a faith-based conversation. That's actually an American culture conversation. And if you're discussing it with another member of American culture, you're on the same playing field. You're having a conversation about that, and your faith commitments come in later when you're reflecting on a particularly Christian way of interacting with productivity or with you know, how we treat veterans or how we treat women's sexuality, right? And that so by starting with some common ground where you're both in a sort of a neutral territory that you both agree about, then when you're introducing your faith commitments later, you're not starting from that place, and you're just bringing in your particular set of commitments to the table. And if it's actually good news, probably people find that attractive. If it's not, that's probably more your problem than Jesus's. So
I think always, and I'm talking about this more from like a hypothetical, I'm not part of a faith community, so I don't operate in that way. So I am on the outside for the purposes of this conversation.
We all get along.
But I think like one of the things that often, you know, when people say, oh, well, how do I talk about this? You know, because I have a lot of churchy friends. And when they say, oh, how do I have this conversation with someone who's outside the church? How do I have this conversation? And like one of the basic rules of the conversation is if you're coming to the table to have a conversation, both parties have to have something at risk in that conversation. So if you're trying to manufacture a conversation to just lay all your cards out on the table and you think you have the winning hand, you're not really having a dialogue. You're not really having a conversation. So there has to be some kind of risk, which means, like Clay said, you have to be listening.
Are you willing to be wrong?
Are you willing to find out you're wrong? You know, like having a conversation, because that's dialogue. Mm-hmm. That's dialogue. So I would say, you know, like, again, having this listening, having this, you know, starting it on general terms that everybody kind of, and then find out what they believe first, you know, like, and endorse that, or, you know, value it, like, really value it, not kind of like, oh, well, that's nice for you, honey, tap, tap, tap.
And then
have that discussion, but really, you know, like, be ready to be challenged, you know, to come away with it and say, huh, I never looked at it that way before.
And don't feel like it comes down to 5 minutes. Like, you don't have to win in 5 minutes. You don't have to lead the person to Jesus.
And it's like, win sounds bad for Sarah.
I lost my opportunity. I had a shot today, and I just ruined eternity. Like, no, yeah. No. It's,
we'll never talk about this movie again.
Right. Like, yeah. Whatever it is, just have a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we all come to the table, what everybody's sort of resonating here is when we all come to the table, the church lives in a great state of division today, and we all lose from that. When we're willing to say, what can we agree on? And what am I willing to learn from you? Not in a rhetorical fashion. We all win. We really do, because we're building unity and leaving discord behind us. And if there's a common ground we can meet on without compromising our individual values, that's a place from which we can all learn to understand each other and engage in further conversations. And it's just, you know, that 5 minutes that you have, it's your elevator pitch that gets you into the next meeting. And if you malign and turn someone away in 5 minutes, you just lost the possibility of hours or maybe even a lifetime of friendship over which you can get to know each other. That's really sad. Thank you all for coming. Please thank our presenters. Aren't these guys awesome? Right?
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.